I have two comments. One is I feel very self-satisfied, but I wish that I'd been a little mellower about doing that rain dance. And the second thing is you're all crazy. What are you doing here? It's pouring outside.
Don't you know that when the
rain hits you, you evaporate?
We should call the cast of a class.
No. So thank you for coming, for turning out in the midst of this happily atypical weather. If you're not on the list, that means by last evening at about 6 o'clock you hadn't yet registered. So you write your name at the bottom of the list, and then when I reprint it next week, your name will appear. Each week, sign in, find your name, and check. If you haven't yet registered, go do that in the office after class. So what you do, again, each week is you find the sign-in sheet and check your name off so that we know who's here each week. And again, if you haven't registered, if you registered after 6 o'clock last evening, then write your name at the bottom of the list and make a check. Next week, your name will be on the list. Okay, Abraham, why don't you make that announcement now?
Yeah, I have the latest book, Poetry and Aphorism. Most of the poems and the aphorisms actually address how we compassionately act and react toward ourselves and the world around us. So it's for sale over there, it's $13 each, and that's all. So we'll come back to the class, and I want to say one thing. Thank you. Rain gods. With the rain we have, we're having. And I want to add also that we want some more.
We'll get some more.
We'll get some more.
Okay. Abraham is our poet laureate. Okay, so a few announcements. And again, for people coming in late, make sure you sign in or sign your name that you're here. Announcements. First, Mind and Supermind. There are two Mind and Supermind events in the spring. One is unfortunately on the same night, Monday night, February 27th, that the lecture at UCSB, a wonderful person, gives. So there's going to be a little bit of a pull about where to go. But the guy that's coming here, Jim Fadiman, is really remarkable. He's been at the beginning of everything. I mean, Jim, wherever consciousness has been developing the past 50 years, Jim was there. For example, those of you who read the book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, at the very beginning of the book, it starts out with a guy sticking coins in the backing of a book to be given to Ken Kesey while he's incarcerated at the Honor Farm somewhere up in the Bay Area. And the guy sticking the coins in is Jim Fadiman. The very first seminar ever given at Esalen Institute, the very first, was given by Willis Harmon and Jim Fadiman. When transpersonal psychology was started, it was started by a few people, one of whom was Jim Fadiman, who also started the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology. When Jim was an undergraduate at Harvard, his best friend was a guy named Richard Alpert, also known as Ramtas. So Jim has a lot to say. So he's coming to this room on February 27th. He'll have a lot to say, and a lot of it will be provocative because that's his nature. And then on May 8th, Rick Parnas comes. Rick Parnas wrote a book called The Passion of the Western Mind, which is a very often used textbook of introductory philosophy all around the world. Rick is absolutely, he started the program at California Institute of Integral Studies in philosophy, cosmology, and consciousness, bringing together physics, psychology, and philosophy. He's a remarkably brilliant and wonderful human being. And I asked him to talk about everything. I said, look, in an hour and a half, why don't you tell us where we've been, where we are, and where we're going as a human race? He said, oh, just that? Sure, absolutely. That's May 8th. And that's Rick. Don't miss that. Just to be in the presence of a guy. To listen to that guy's mind work is amazing.
Okay.
You said that was May 8th?
That's May 8th, yeah. And you know, it'll sell out, so get it while you can. Okay, two classes to be aware of. One is the class a week from tomorrow, in this room, I think, by Joseph Bobro, the Zen master and activist. A lot of you know him, came and spoke in this class last term. It's called Kissing the Joy as It Flies, Zen Buddhism and the Life Well Lived. And it's a few hours on Saturday, the 28th. Flyers are over on the table. He says he's particularly going to talk about what we do in this time of challenge, because he's both a Zen Buddhist and a very passionate activist. For example, when the call went out for clergy people to go to Standing Rock about a month ago, 2 months ago, he went to Standing Rock. He walks his talk. And then Carl, are you here? I don't see Carl. Okay, Carl Glacius is a member of our class, teaches this wonderful class in leading edge biology, especially in the biology of aging, what we're learning. So he's got a two-session class on Thursday evenings, February 9th and 16th, called Advances in Biology, Aging in the Brain, where he very authoritatively, but very clearly, runs down what we're learning about how to prevent some of the things that we thought were inevitable that have to do with brain aging. So if you're at all interested in leading edge biology, and especially in thought about how you stay healthy longer, Carl's class is, he's a real resource. He really does it right. He understands the material and he presents it really clearly and in depth. Okay, mindfulness. This class, if you're new to this class, you have no idea what you got yourself into, but you will. Generally, we always start out with a 10-minute mindfulness, a 10-minute sitting. You can do any kind of meditation you wish. If you're doing mindfulness, I coach you each week. And this week, I'm going to give you some intermediate coaching, okay? Because a lot of you have been sitting for quite a while now, and you kind of are sitting high on your horse. So I've kind of got a... dismount you and remount you, right? Okay. But for those who have never done mindfulness before, this explains it all, and I'll explain it all in like 1 minute. Usually you walk around with thoughts in your head, feelings in your body, and sensations coming in. And when the weather's good, you're happy. When the weather's bad, you get soaked. If you would like to be mindful, just keep returning attention to your breathing no matter what. Just keep feeling how your breathing physically feels. Don't try to change it. And you will take one step back from this stuff because you'll be focusing on your breathing, and you'll notice this stuff without losing your breathing. You'll be watching this, not being this. So when the weather's bad, it's really nice to watch it from inside, or from the eye of the hurricane, not being in the hurricane. And all you do to do this is you keep coming back to your breathing and feel your breathing physically. Which leads me to the comment for you sitting high on your horse intermediate meditators, which is, you are not trying, there's no trying, you are not trying to establish the witnessing perspective. when you try to, and I'm speaking from my own experience here, when you try to establish a witnessing perspective, what you do is, yes, you label, oh yeah, that's a thought, that's a feeling, I'm doing so well with witnessing perspective, but what you're doing is substituting one kind of thought for another. You're just substituting a more subtle kind of thought for the grosser kind of thought. So I sit down, I establish my witnessing perspective, I'm meditating so well, I'm lost in the thought that I'm meditating so well, that I'm being mindful. Does that make sense to people? So the solution to this is to go back to the beginning of your practice. They say that this practice is the alpha and omega. It's the beginning and the end of practice, which is just do two things. Pay attention to what's moving as you breathe, your belly, maybe your chest, you know, the whole body kind of expands and contracts. Just pay attention to the breathing itself. Don't try to witness. That will bring you out of, that'll bring you to thought. Instead, just feel yourself breathe. And after a while, as you hang out with your breathing, you'll clearly notice stuff which takes you away from your breathing. There's a thought, and I got absorbed in it. Now, where's my breathing? Back to my breathing. Breathing, breathing. Now I can hear my thought without getting lost in it. Now I'm witnessing. But the minute I start to witness, or I try to witness, I lose the mindful perspective, and I go into some kind of subtle thought. So you just feel your breathing. That's all you're doing. Feel your breathing and notice whatever else is occurring without losing your breathing. First thing. Second thing, this is not really about paying attention to your breathing. It's not really even about paying attention to what's happening. It's about opening. So while you're breathing, let yourself open. Let yourself soften. At every level, and there are so many levels. For example, you is a contraction. You really let yourself open, you dissolves. So you kind of just go like this at every level. And there's level after level to discover and to allow to open. So you're breathing and you're opening. That's all. Okay? So let's sit for 10 minutes. Say again? No, there's no third thing.
He said, there is no.
All right, so we're going to sit for 10 minutes. You can do whatever you like during the sitting as long as it doesn't disturb anybody. But if you are doing mindfulness, breathing, softening, and opening. again, I want to thank you for creating such a good space to meditate in, good feeling. If you would like guidance about how to be mindful, either reading some things or audio program, go to my website, drspencershowme.com, or go to many other places. And if you would like to listen to any past class, go to swt.org/Spencer. That's Robert's website, and Michael records the classes and puts them on that website. Also, occasionally, Michael will put out CDs with recording classes that you can borrow or take. I'm going to turn the lights on because we're going to shift gears now. All right, so this is not a polished lecture. Okay, I have not given it before, and I didn't have a lot of time this week to go over it again and again and again. So I'm going to refer to my notes. It's not going to be terribly smooth, but hopefully it will make sense. So what I'm going to do is talk to you about this thing for a while, and then if there's time, I want you to talk amongst yourselves for a little while, and then I want to show you a really inspiring video. And that will end our morning sessions. Okay, so here we go. How am I going to do this? I probably want to sit up here. Okay, so we are living in an extraordinary time, certainly, but one of the ways in which this time is extraordinary is that we are witnessing right now, and especially in California, a synthesis of the two great philosophic traditions of the world, the Eastern point of view and the Western point of view. They're coming together right now, and they're creating something beyond either of them. So, and it's happening very rapidly, I'm very excited about it, and we all, I think, are caught up in it, and part of this synthesis of something new out of thousands of years of tradition. And I could talk about it in many different ways, but I've selected three of the ways in which seemingly contradictory ways to look at the world and ways to operate in the world are bringing a new way to look at the world and operate in the world. Another way to look at this is there's yin, which is the East, and there's yang, which is the West, and now we're creating the whole circle. But these things seem opposite, black and white, you know, light and dark, East and West. So let's look at three ways in which the opposites are joining. A basic stance of Eastern philosophy, psychology, religion, okay, is exemplified by Buddha's Four Noble Truths. First noble truth, life is suffering. Second noble truth, there's a way out of suffering. Third and most important noble truth, the way out of suffering is non-attachment. Fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path, which is the way that you live such that you can do non-attachment. So the basic idea here is not to push and pull on things, to let things be. The poem Verses on the Faith Mind by Sengstan, 3rd Zen Patriarch, 7th century AD. And I'm probably going to distribute this poem to you at some point, and we're going to go over it line by line, because it makes absolutely no sense until you understand it, and then it makes such stunningly perfect sense that it becomes one of the greatest things ever written.
So here's how it begins. Okay. This is, again, a poem in the 7th century AD by the third Zen patriarch. The great way is not difficult for those who hold no preferences. The great way is not difficult for those who hold no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the slightest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. So what is this long poem that we're going to look at beginning to say? What does the beginning of it say? Don't strive for this. Don't try to change anything. The sum total of this, of Eastern thought, is acceptance. It is what it is. Deal with it as it is. Don't try to grasp it, right? To hold it to you or push it away. Now let's look at Western thought.
Who was the poem by?
Sengstein. Oh, just Google The Great Way and it will come up a trillion times. But again, I'll give it, I print it, I'll give it to you. Okay. It's gorgeous and amazing. Okay. Okay, Wes. There are many different ways that I could encapsulate what the West says, but what I did is I just wrote down a bunch of words that I'm going to read to you, and the sum total of those words will give you the idea. Strive. Discover. Strive. Discover. Conquer. Progress. Solve. Cure. Grow. Develop. Don't worry about writing this down. You can see you have my notes if you like. Okay. Increase. Ascend. Attain. Win. Triumph. Perfect. In other words, improve yourself and the world. So we got the East saying, accept it as it is, and we got the West saying, change it. We got the East saying, you're perfect the way you are, you just have to remember that. You got the West saying, you got a lot of work to do. You got original sin, folks, you know. You gotta. Okay, so the contradiction is between accepting things as they are and changing things for the better. How does this synthesize right now? Well, I went to on Tuesday, I went to a forum at UCSB, or I was part of a forum at UCSB, about mindfulness and social justice, which would seem to be opposites, right? Mindfulness is about, it is what it is. Social justice is about, hey, it's not okay the way that it is. We've got to do some activism here. First Tuesday, there's something called First Tuesday that's starting to happen in the meditation community. Abraham was there. The first Tuesday at the Episcopalian Church at State and Mitchell Terena, various meditation groups all gathered together, or various now religious groups and spiritual groups all gathered together, and they kind of talked to one another about mutual concerns. And the mutual concern of this past First Tuesday was about, what do you do in this time that we're in, typified by what's happening today in Washington, D.C.? Like, what do you do? How do you be a meditator and at the same time deal with what you're going to have to deal with and what you need to do? You know, synthesis. So how do you put these two together? Leave it alone and change it. The synthesis, if I may be so bold, and I am, in this case, is to say that what you do is, on a personal level, you maintain a peaceful, calm, equanimity, You have respect and humility. You listen to the other person. You realize that everybody's expressing basic needs, and it's important to create situations where everybody feels that their needs are being met. In other words, you behave in a very mindful Buddhist way. But on the collective level, you strive to create win-win solutions out of conflict, out of things that aren't working right for everybody. You make efforts to make things better for everybody. You work from compassion, but you work. So when you're doing your activism, you do it very actively, but you do it very proactively, not reactively. You're working for something, not against something. There's no enemy. There's just people that have a different idea than you have, and you have to dialogue with those people about how everybody can be okay. So you have to go into battle not in a bellicose way. You have to go into battle for peace, for what is best. Now, there's a lot more that you probably have to say about that, and in a little while you'll get to. Okay. But let's leave that one here, okay? To go to the second seeming contradiction, which is right now being unified. Okay. In the East, we talk about non-attachment. I just mentioned that, right? The idea that you don't push or pull on things, that you're non-attached. In the West, the cornerstone of Western developmental psychology at this point is what? Attachment theory. The idea is attachment is really important, okay? So it would seem to be a contradiction, non-attachment and the centrality of attachment for human well-being. So how do you put these two together? Well, if you look at Western attachment theory, you see that there are three levels of attachment. There are three possibilities for attachment in infants. Two of those possibilities are unhealthy. People who are anxiously attached, kids who are anxiously attached, grasp too hard because they're afraid the love is going to be taken away. Kids that are avoidantly attached, they push away mama because mama has either been too painful or hasn't made the right kind of connection. So anxious attachment, grasping, or avoidant attachment, pushing away, are unhealthy. What's healthy is secure attachment, when you use the attachment to mom as a secure base from which to go out and explore the world. Well, when you look at Buddhist thought, it says that it's what's unhealthy, what you don't want to do with regard to attachment, is you don't want to grasp. You don't want it to pull toward you. You don't want to push away. You want to deal with life with an open hand so that it can come and it can go, so that you're open to possibility, but you're not manipulating the world. So it's the same idea. The idea in attachment theory is you want to have the kind of attachment that allows the child to grow into who she or he really is without your trying to make them into who you want them to be. So what I wrote is, always be present and available, but don't try to force anything with regard to parenting. So in the West, when we look at attachment theory, we're actually looking at a prescription for a certain kind of attachment, which seems to be consonant with the Eastern idea of not grasping, of not having a closed hand, having an open hand. Another Eastern and Western approach that show this healthy kind of dealing with the world, the Tao Te Ching, the Tao Te Ching. What does it say about how you govern a country? It doesn't say you don't govern a country, because a country does need to be governed. You have to put your hands on the country, otherwise there's chaos. what it says about governing a country, this is Taoism, right? The foundation of Taoism. What it says about governing a country or pretty much anything else, so remember this, when I teach, I really remember that this isn't just about governing, it's also about teaching or any kind of leading. The Tao Te Ching says there are four levels of leader. It's not where I wanted to go with this, but I'll tell you this one anyway, and I'll go where I'm going to go. The Tao Te Ching says four levels of leader. The tyrant that you obey because you have to, the heavy-handed one. The bureaucrat that everybody goes along with because somebody has to shuffle the papers. The great leader that everybody adores and pulls toward them. The wonderful president, the wonderful whatever. And the superior leader, of which the people say, leader? What leader? We did it ourselves. The person who has such a light touch that you don't even know that you're being led or taught. So the Tao Te Ching says, very famously, how do you govern a large country? As you would cook a small fish, lightly. Fry a small fish, lightly. So the idea in Eastern thought is you do have to operate in the world, but you operate in the world in the most harmonious way. Donald Winnicott, a famous family researcher, says about parenting, you don't want to be the kind of parent that everybody's trying to be these days. You don't want to be an Uber parent, a helicopter parent. You don't want to be the perfect parent. Because the consequence of being the perfect parent, of having your hands too much on what happens to the kid, is the children never grow up. Because everything is done for them, they don't get to rise to any challenge because there is no challenge. Furthermore, there's no possible way that you could be as perfect as mom, so you don't even try. Winnicott says, very, very famously, the kind of parent you want to be is a good enough parent. When you're a good enough parent, you make mistakes, and the kid has to step forward to correct your mistakes. And you show that you're human, so the kid thinks, I could be like him or her, because they're human, they make mistakes too. Okay. So the idea in parenting, from Winnicott's point of view, is you don't do it with too heavy of a hand. You do it with a lighter touch. So there seems to be a confluence of East and West about how you move through the world. You move through the world in the most, with the lightest touch, the openest hand that you can, still making effect. Okay, the most well-known, probably, of the conflicts between East and West, seemingly, is about the notion of self. Because the East comes from a collectivist cultural orientation, the idea is you want no self. You want the self to dissolve. You don't want the separateness of self. The second of the three great turnings of the wheel of Dharma in Buddhism, that is, ways of basic philosophic understandings in Buddhism. The first is the Four Noble Truths, how to deal with suffering. The second is the illusoriness of the separate self and the development of a moving through life in a non-selfed way. And again, that comes from the collectivist idea that you're not a me, you're a we. The Western ideal, because the West comes from the individualist point of view. So the Western ideal is to create a strong sense of self. Right? Freud said, you want ego strength. You want where id was, there shall ego be. You want the sense of self to become more and more embracing of who you are and more secure. Most all psychologies are designed to help people go from a weak sense of self to a strong sense of self. So there seems to be a contradiction here between The ideal being not having a sense of self, and the ideal having a very strong sense of self. Okay, but let's look more closely at both points of view. Okay? The Eastern point of view. The goal in the East is not really the dissolution of the self. The goal is the realization of non-duality. That non-duality, that is the understanding that everything is part of the same thing. It's all one at the base. You know, that's the foundation of every spiritual system in the world. There's only one thing. It's all the same thing. It's illusory at some level that things seem separate. And the whole spiritual growth process is a process of realizing the oneness that you forgot about. When God made everything, everything forgot that it was God, and now everything's got to remember that it's God. You know, that's kind of the process. So the goal in the East is the realization of non-separateness, of the fact that even though you walk around in a body and even though you have a personality, you're fundamentally not separate than other people and what's outside you. There's a fundamental unity underneath the feeling of separateness. So what dissolves is a feeling of separateness. So how do we see this in Eastern thought? In a lot of ways, but one way is the Zen ox herding pictures that some of you know about that I'll probably take you through again, though I've done it before in this class. It's the 10 stages of enlightenment portrayed as seeking and finding the ox of your true nature. And those of you who know the ox herding pictures, the highest levels of enlightenment are the 8th and 9th ox herding pictures. Way incredibly refined consciousness, when in the 8th ox herding picture, there's no self at all. Just the Zen circle, the empty circle. Okay? That's what the person is at that level. No self. And then the 9th ox herding picture is the living the realization that the manifest comes out of the unmanifest and falls back into the manifest. The source and what it creates are the same dynamic process. And that's what that person who is that enlightened is. It's just a manifestation of everything coming out of nothing and going back to nothing. And that the distinction between everything and nothing being a distinction that is healed, that is, it is the everything and the nothing. I know these are fancy words. We'll talk about this in more detail at some point and make it much more approachable. But that's not where it ends in the ox herding pictures. Where it ends is with the 10th ox herding picture, the highest degree of enlightenment. And what's the 10th ox herding picture? A fat, jolly rustic with a loincloth on and a smile on his or her face and a gourd of wine on his or her hip, walking into the marketplace with helping hands, entering the marketplace with helping hands, and helping the fishmonger wrap fish, and helping the wood chopper chop wood, and helping the latrine cleaner clean the latrine. And everybody that comes in contact with this person is to some degree enlightened. So this is a person who has regained a sense of self, but it's not a sense of self that has any degree of separateness from what it moves through. The self is just a vehicle for spirit to move through the world. So the idea in the East is you have a self that has no separation. You've still got a self. And when you look at these really enlightened masters, guess what? They all have selves. Some of them have a hell of a lot of self. But even the most refined ones have a self. It doesn't go away. As Stephen Gaskin, the guy that did the Monday night class at Haight-Ashbury, used to say, ego is like barnacles on the physical plane. It just grows on the physical plane. Doesn't matter how spiritual you are. If you're on the physical plane, you're going to get ego. It's just going to keep reconstituting. Okay? So the idea to put East and West together about self is it's not a question of not having a self. And it's not a question about having a very highly defending self. It's a question of having a sense of self that is very present and available. So a self with a semi-permeable membrane as a boundary rather than a wall. Okay. And that's what we're striving, you know. Jack Kornfield is both a mindfulness teacher and a psychologist, because what we're striving for here is a new definition of what it means to be in, especially healthy in the world. And it's a definition beyond that which anything in the West has come up with, and it's really not the world we live in. It's really kind of hard to spend your life sitting in a cave. You know, there's got to be a way to move through the world in a semi-enlightened, in extremely healthy way. That's going to involve having a sense of self, but a transformed sense of self, or an enriched, enhanced sense of self. Manifestations of this emerging synthesis. One is Abraham Maslow, ahead of his time, when he talked about self-actualizing people, the very healthiest people that he could find in the world that he studied, he said that self-actualizing people have an extraordinarily secure sense of self. So much so that they don't self. That is, they're so at home with themselves, confident in themselves, at peace with themselves, that they don't think about themselves. They're focused on other people and what they're doing. They're not selfing when they walk around. They're not, did I do that right? Did I do that wrong? They're paying total attention to you and what they're doing, because the sense of self has been, to some degree, opened or transcended. So, because of the sense of self that they have, the strength of self, they don't need to keep working on it, manifesting it. They can go beyond it. Positive psychology says two seemingly contradictory things. It says you want to use your strengths of personality to create the strongest self you can create. And positive psychology talks a lot about how you create a good, strong sense of self. And at the same time, what positive psychology says, and it's a very new wrinkle in Western thought, is you want to spend as much time as possible in flow. You know what flow is. We've talked about it. Flow is when you're so into the person you're talking to or the thing that you're doing that there's no sense of self at all. The sense of self goes away. You're unified with what you're doing or what the person that you're with. So positive psychology says you want to move back and forth between a strong sense of self and no self. That sounds a lot like the Eastern idea that you enter the marketplace with helping hands. So you, just to emphasize this, what you do from a point of view of positive psychology, if you're especially healthy, is sometimes you work from your self, your strong sense of self, to help yourself and other people, and sometimes you completely let go into what you're doing and into who you're being with. So you go like this. It's like breathing, self merging. Self-merging. And what Mike Csikszentmihalyi, the flow guy, says is the people that we clearly empirically demonstrated to be the happiest people in the society are the people who have the most flow, the people who spend the most time not in themselves. And, by the way, the people that are the unhappiest in society are the people who spend the most time self-focused. That is, if the definition of being a neurotic is you spend all of your energy on yourself, so there's none left to do anything. Because you're constantly worried about, should I do this? Shouldn't I do this? Did I do it right? Didn't I do it right? It's like you walk through life with a rear view mirror on, and you're only looking at yourself. You can barely see where you're going. And depression has to do with rumination, right? You're always thinking, did I do it? It's always about self. So the prescription in Western psychology is you kind of want to get out of yourself as much as possible, rather than stay self-focused. Unless you're really, really, really depressed, you can ask a person that's only moderately depressed, were you depressed when you were watching that movie? And they say, no, I was watching the movie. I go, no. Were you depressed when you were talking to that person that you really, really like talking to? No. But the minute I stopped talking to her, it fell on me like a ton of bricks. What fell on you like a ton of bricks? I started thinking about myself again. Okay. Anyway, the sense of self, enough about sense of self. So the idea in East and West is you want a sense of self that doesn't imprison you, doesn't constrain you, but empowers you. Okay, now what I want to do is I want to do something that I don't generally do in this class, but I want to do it today because I think it's important. I want to give you 10 minutes to talk with one another in small groups, groups of about 3 or 4. And you don't have to do this if you don't want to, but and you have to talk quietly. But what I'd like you to talk about, if you want to, is how you are dealing with what's going on right now in the world. What is your own personal way of coping? How are you feeling about this, and what are you doing toward making yourself and the world feel better, first? And second question is, if you want to answer this question, what's your own personal synthesis of East and West? How do you put together what you've learned about Eastern thought and what you've learned about Western health? So first question, which I'm sure everybody's going to have something to say about, is how you're coping right now. Second question, if you want to, is how are you self-defining these days? How are you putting together your practice, your Eastern understanding, and your Western desire to become a happy, healthy person? So why don't you take 10 minutes at the most, and just let everybody say a little bit, and listen to one another. This is not a debate. Each person just gets to say, okay? So do that. I'll ring the chimes in 10 minutes, okay? So do that.
I Thank you.
Show you. So let's kind of get back in the plenary session here. First of all, this is an exceptional group of people. I hope that when you come here, get here a little early, you talk to your neighbor. I would like people to talk to one another. I would like people to feel like they're part of a conscious community. It's really kind of important in this time that we're in that you feel like you're not alone and that you can talk to people and express what's bottled up in you and get some good ideas about how to proceed and maybe even decide on some mutual courses of action. Do get to know these folks. Second, while I remember, if you didn't sign in on the way out, check your name off. If it's on the list, if it's not on the list, write your name at the bottom, make a check, and then make sure that you register. If you registered after 6 p.m. last night, you're not on the list, but you're registered. If you haven't registered yet, register at the office so that when I reprint this thing for next week, it represents people who are registered. I know we should have a group, a big discussion now about what we just talked about. We're not going to. We don't have time. Okay. I want to show you a video. This class is about being increasing one's feeling of being alive. It's about what makes well-being. And we're going to approach it from many different points of view, but all of which are designed to help you be inspired to be more passionate about what you're doing in life, how you're being in life, what you're doing in life. And I thought that this would be a perfect beginning video to show you with regard to inspiring you in that way. A few of you have probably seen this before. It's worth seeing multiple times. But many of you have not, and so you're about to see something really wonderful, or a really wonderful person. Okay, so in order to see videos with this woefully inadequate projection system, I didn't say that, we need to close the major, the red drapes. And if possible, can you get that one closer? It's the other one, not that one. It's the one on the other side, Adrian. Down there. So that we get it as dark as possible in here, so that we can actually see this. I'm not sure about the sound here, so I would put my hands over my ears right now for a minute because I might have turned it up too loud, but let's see. This is Isabel Allende, the writer.
Who will be at St.
I'm 71. My husband is 76. My parents are in their late 90s. And Olivia, the dog, is 16. So let's talk about aging. Let me tell you how I feel when I see my wrinkles in the mirror, and I realize that some parts of me have dropped, and I can't find them down there. Mary Oliver says in one of her poems, "Tell me, what is it that you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Me, I intend to live passionately." When do we start aging? Society decides when we are old, usually around 65, when we get Medicare. But we really start aging at birth. We're aging right now, and we all experience it differently. We all feel younger than our real age, because the spirit never ages. I am still 17. Sophia Loren, look at her. She says that everything you see, she also spaghetti. I tried it and gained 10 pounds in the wrong places. But attitude. Aging is also attitude and health. But my real mentor in this journey of aging is Olga Murray. This California girl at 60 started working in Nepal to save young girls from domestic bondage. At 88, she has saved 12,000 girls, and she has changed the culture in the country. Now it is illegal for fathers to sell their daughters into servitude. She has also founded orphanages and nutritional clinics. She is always happy and eternally young. What have I lost in the last decades? People, of course. Places and the boundless energy of my youth. And I'm beginning to lose independence, and that scares me. Ram Dass says that dependency hurts, but if you accept it, there is less suffering. After a very bad stroke, his ageless soul watches the changes in the body with tenderness, and he is grateful to the people who help him. What have I gained? Freedom, I won't have to prove anything anymore. I'm not stuck in the idea of who I was, who I want to be, or what other people expect me to be. I won't have to please men anymore. Only animals. I keep telling my superego to back off and let me enjoy what I still have. My body may be falling apart, but my brain is not yet. I love my brain. I feel lighter. I don't carry grudges, ambition, vanity, none of the deadly sins that are not even worth the trouble. It's great to let go. I should have started sooner. And I also feel softer because I'm not scared of being vulnerable. I don't see it as weakness anymore. And I've gained spirituality. I'm aware that before, death was in the neighborhood. Now, it's next door or in my house. I try to live mindfully and be present in the moment. By the way, the Dalai Lama is someone who has aged beautifully, but who wants to be vegetarian and celibate?
Vegetarian and celibate.
Meditation helps. Oh, there it is. I'm supposed to start early. You know, for a vain female like myself, it's very hard to age in this culture. Inside, I feel good. I feel charming, seductive, sexy. Nobody else sees that. I'm invisible. I want to be the center of attention. I hate to be invisible. This is Grace Dammann. She has been in a wheelchair for 6 years after a terrible car accident. She says that There is nothing more sensual than a hot shower, that every drop of water is a blessing to the senses. She doesn't see herself as disabled. In her mind, she's still surfing in the ocean. Ethel Zilberman, a feisty, beloved activist in the place where I live in California, she wears red patent shoes, and her mantra is that one scarf is nice, but two is better. She has been a widow for 9 years, but she's not looking for another mate. She says that there is only a limited number of ways you can screw. Well, she says it in another way. And she has tried them all. I, on the other hand, I still have erotic fantasies with Antonio Banderas. And my poor husband has to put up with it. So how can I stay passionate? I cannot will myself to be passionate at 71. I have been training for some time. And when I feel flat on board, I fake it. Attitude. How do I train? I train by saying yes to whatever comes my way. Drama, comedy, tragedy, love, death, losses. Yes to life. And I train by trying to stay in love. It doesn't always work, but you cannot blame me for trying. And on a final note, retirement in Spanish is jubilación, jubilation, celebration. We have paid our dues, we have contributed to society, now it's our time. And it's a great time. Unless you are ill or very poor, you have choices. I have chosen to stay passionate, engaged with an open heart. I'm working on it every day. Want to join me?
For the TED community, but I would like to tell you that I have a feeling we can all agree that you are still charming, seductive, and sexy. Yes? Hands down.
No, it's makeup.
Now, would it be awkward if I asked you a follow-up question about your erotic fantasies?
Oh, yes. About what?
About your erotic fantasies.
I'm just wondering if
you have anything more to share.
Well, one of them is that... One of them is that I place a naked Antonio Banderas on a Mexican tortilla. I slather him with guacamole and salsa. I roll him up and I eat him.
So that's Isabella Allende.
Because we have, yeah, she's wonderful. She's really wonderful. Because we have just a few minutes, I'm gonna have a 4-minute discussion here, okay? Because I want to say something and maybe have a comment or two from you. I don't remember their first name. Anderson and Ray, maybe 20 years ago, wrote a book about spiral dynamics and various sections that they found in American society. And one section that they found was about 50 million people they called the cultural creatives. And they said, this group of people are people who want to make the world a better place, who are concerned about ecology and being green and justice for everybody. But they said that the cultural creatives are not a potent political force in the country. And the reason for that is because they don't cohere. There's no sense of coming together. There's no sense of that group of people as a block. They're mostly concerned with their own development and with yoga and with meditation and with recycling and stuff. And I think what has happened very, very recently is a lot of people that were kind of complacent and kind of focused on self-development have started to talk to one another and cohere. So I think that what we're going to see in the marches tomorrow is a lot of people who got up off their yoga mats and said, hey, we got to speak together, and we got to work in concert here. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing that, people are speaking up in this country and not just kind of doing business as usual. Okay, Robert.
Yeah, sorry, I said this.
Loud.
Sorry, I already said this in a small group. But I think the problem that I have is that for 50 years, since the U.S. war in Vietnam, people are very good at coming together to be against stuff. But one of the appeals that Trump had that I think is valid is that we should have a collective, great, positive vision. I don't believe for a minute that Trump has one, but the problem is I'm not sure our side has had one, and I think that each of us should think about what is the great, positive, collective vision that we should have.
So that's a that's probably the last comment we'll have. That's a really good comment. There's a guy named Nick Marks. I showed some of you a video that Nick Marks did on how to create healthy, what a healthy society would look like. What Nick Marks is a remarkable TED talk. M-A-R-K-S, N-I-C Marks. What he said is, we're going about it the wrong way when we want to change people. We're trying to frighten people into being ecologically conscious. We're saying, yeah, the world is going to go to hell if you don't do this, you know. And people run away, they freeze or they run away from threat. That's what's in their brain to do. If we want people to do something, we have to show them what good will accrue. We have to give them a vision to work toward, not something to work against. And I think that's really important to remember in what you do, that what you're doing is you're not contesting with other people to show that you're right and they're wrong. What you're doing is you're trying to create something positive and helpful for all. You're going toward as opposed to against. All right, Morty, I know you're going to contradict me, but you might as well.
No, no, no. I just want to mention that this Valiente is going to be at the Bernard on April 18th. He's going to be here in town.
Who is?
This Valiente.
Oh, Isabel Lenny's going to be here on April 18th?
Yes, he is.
Cool. Okay. All right, so I think, you know, there's a lot to say about this. Talk to one another. We'll talk about this further. We do need to adjourn. And hopefully we're going to walk out into, well, we'll see, but I don't hear any trouble coming from that. So we may